The podcast you're about to listen to is a combination of the show broadcast on Sunday the 28th of March and on Tuesday the 30th of March. Unfortunately, technical issues prevented us from sharing with our audience the interviews from Councillor Gerald Vernon-Jackson and Councillor Terry Norton in our show on Sunday the 28th, two days. So I hope that doesn't spoil your enjoyment of the show. Thank you for listening.
The time is 6:27 p.m.
And welcome to the Pompey Politics Podcast.
Blue and yellow till we die. I'm Ian Tiny Morris.
And I'm Simon Sainsbury. Aside from the connection problems that you had that struggled to get you in, are you all right, mate?
Yes, I am poised and ready for another Sunday evening of fun and or frolics. So, just coming off the back of 2 weeks holiday, so ready to get back into the fray tomorrow. We've been decluttering, so all good. We are poised and ready to leap in. Yourself?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. Aside from some hurried editing this afternoon. But thank you very much to our contributors that have, even though they sadly they couldn't give us time to be with us live today, we've got a couple of recorded comments that we can share, which is really great. So thank you very much to Gerald Vernon-Jackson and Councillor Terry Norton for giving us those, and we do have Kimberly Barrett joining us live. I noticed weirdly from the live stream, by the way, that and I never knew this was happening before, but our words are being transcribed live.
Yeah, that is a new thing. So we appear in subtitles. Yeah, it's a clever old thing.
Well, there we go. Who knew the internet, this thing will never catch on.
Marvellous.
Yes, absolutely fantastic. So, sorry, Lynn, that was my fault with the music not being audible. That's because I had it too low on the mixer desk with me pressing buttons madly. So,
yeah, usually, Lynn, we go through a comprehensive series of sound checks and thoroughly prepare for this. When the co-host crashes through the door 27 seconds before we go live, unfortunately, we had to forego that thoroughness. So apart from technical-based disasters, Simon, what happened on this day?
So on this day, in 1866, the first ambulance goes into service. And hopefully they're not still waiting for it.
Yeah.
In 1979, a partial meltdown at Three Mile Island nuclear plant in the US. So there was a release of radioactive gas and iodine into the atmosphere, but no deaths, thank you very much, no fatalities.
Yeah, that's a good thing, because that could have gone horribly wrong. I mean, it wasn't pretty, but by comparison, yes.
Indeed, yes. So could have been worse, but horrible thing. 1979, the British government of Jim Callaghan falls.
Jim Callaghan.
Falling government.
I would have been 10 at the time. I sort of vaguely remember him. Much lampooned, if I remember right. A man with a pipe. Wouldn't see a politician with a pipe these days, would you? As in a smoking pipe. I mean, didn't just carry around like a...
I was going to say...
tubing.
Or whatever that might be a euphemism for. So, nonetheless... yes, great. And the last thing, 2006, at least 1 million union members, students and unemployed take to the streets in France in protest at the government's proposed first employment contract law, which brought into place legislation that allowed employers to more easily dismiss people who were being employed for their first job.
They love a bit of a protest in France, don't they? Mad keen on it. So, but perhaps we'll save that for another day. So, packed show this week, three topics to cover.
Yes. So the three things. So, do you want to lead off with put our teeth in and explain what they are? Go for it.
Yeah. Oh, this is so slick to this week, aren't we? So, yes, the first is about after May the 6th and some of the changing of the easing of the lockdown laws, part of that bill that went through said, councils, enough of your home streaming. time to get you back into the council chamber, which a little bit head scratchy, but we'll get some views on that. The St. James's development, the developer has stepped forward this week to say that unfortunately, if they were to put any affordable housing on there, that they would not be able to afford to feed their children. So they've said, can we build it without any affordable housing? And the final is the great, we're not going to go into the flags, but we've got the EU and the UK vaccines. Should we call it a squabble at the moment? I don't think we use the word squabble often enough. And I'm interested to know whether the transcription is getting that one right.
It would be interesting to see whether it gets that one right. I guess you could say we'll take a jab at the international vaccine spat. How was that?
A boom. Like that.
Like that. And I playfully had my EU flag up in the corner. But I've kind of removed that now because I was just being a bit fun. So although we've announced them in that order, that's not the order we're going to do them in, because we're not like that. So the first one that we're going to look at is St. James's. We've got our live guest poised like a coiled zebra is Kimberly Barrett, who's going to come on, who's been on before, obviously, talked to us. Very passionate campaigner in Milton. So let's welcome Kimberly Barrett on to the show. He clicks the button and hopes. Yay. There is the ding dong. The sound is...
Good evening, Kimberly.
It's not Avon.
Hiya.
Hi, Kimberly.
Hiya.
Thank you for giving up part of your Sunday to come join us.
Anytime.
you might live to regret that. So St. James's. So apparently the developer can't afford affordable housing. What's going on?
What a shock, eh? What a shock. It's something that comes up quite frequently. I think we've seen it over the city over many years, but it's a real shame. Just a little bit of background. St. James Hospital at the moment is split almost into what we class as phase one, which is the east side of the hospital grounds. And then you've got the west side, which is the main hospital ground, main hospital building and the grounds around it. Currently potentially owned anyway by two different developers. Phase one is Homes England. They want to build 107 homes there, but they will provide affordable housing and the correct amount of affordable housing if planning goes through. Phase two, we were promised several times in public meetings and emails and all sorts. They're looking to build 151 flats and houses there, and now no affordable homes at all. So it's a real disappointment if these do go through, that once again it's local people who will end up suffering because we have the lack of affordable homes.
Yeah, and it's an interesting one, Kimberly, isn't it? Because I had a bit of a read around the subject, and evidently, from what I could work out, the developer says that with the, basically, I sort of said it was your fault, really, the local residents of Milton, because originally they had wanted to put 84 new builds as well as the redevelopment of the existing building, and you feisty green types cut that down to 58, which has left them now, meaning that they're not going to meet their 20% profit threshold. So they're only going to make £18.4 million profit, and that's why they can't afford any affordable homes. You've got a feel for them, haven't you?
I know, it's terrible, isn't it?
Can we do a Kickstarter for them?
Well, you might have to. I mean, it's shocking, really. I mean, there's this 20% threshold, and they're literally, I think it's something like 1.2%, they're thinking that they'll be below that threshold. I mean, you're still talking, tens of millions of pounds that they're going to make in profit. They'll walk away from this site with that money in their pocket. And I always think profit is profit at the end of the day. These are seasoned developers who've done this over and over again on multiple sites. They know what they're getting into. They know the value of the land. they know legally how much affordable housing they're meant to provide. And yet time and time again, they use viability assessments, Section 106, to do their best to skimp out on giving these affordable housing needs to the local people. And it will be us as citizens of this city who will miss out because we desperately need these affordable homes. I mean, affordable homes is a term that can be debatable anyway, but you know, we need these affordable homes, whether it's housing association homes for people who desperately need them to come off the council list, or we need these part rent, part buy homes for people to get on the first ladder and, you know, get out of homes, free them up for other people if they can afford to take this first step onto the property ladder. And, you know, it ends up that, you know, you have so many people on the council list who desperately need these homes. And in the end, we do, as, you know, quite rightly, you know, we have to support people who are in need, but it, you know, we have to pay for them to go into bed sits or other accommodation if there's not enough housing for them by the council. And it comes out of our purse strings when it comes to council tax. And it's just unfortunate that, you know, these developers will walk away with a nice tidy profit, you know, 18 million plus is not really something to be scoffed at. And, you know, it's us that suffer for it in the end.
Yeah.
So we asked, carry on, Simon.
No, that's fine. It sounds like you were just about to do exactly what I was just about to do, which is to say that we asked Cal Corkery, who's a Labour councillor, who's also very passionate and outspoken about housing matters and about concerns about levels of affordable housing. And we also reached out via him to Paula Ann Savage, also who's very interested in the events in Milton with regards to if they wanted to come on and make a comment or record any comment. And sadly, neither were available. But our recorded submissions that we had, thankfully, from Councillor Terry Norton, although we offered for him to comment on this, he reminded us that as someone that's actually on the planning committee, it would be improper for him to actually pass a comment on this particular issue, because that would put him in a difficult situation, and the developer would be in a situation where they could say, well, hang on a minute, our case hasn't been heard with an open mind. But he did have a point to raise that he made actually towards the so we wouldn't pay we won't play his clip on this bit, but we will later on. But Ian, I don't know if you wanted to pick up on the, because I thought it was an interesting point that he'd made actually with regards to affordable housing.
Yeah, and the point that I think you know, Terry was making is that the onus for affordable housing, should it be on commercial developers, or should it really be sitting, you know, with the local council to make the right levels of investment for affordable housing? Because I think one of the things you've acknowledged there, Kimberly, is almost every one of these commercial developments that comes to the council for approval, you know, there are these statutes that say they should deliver a certain percentage, and every time the viability assessment says that they can't afford to do it. So I guess, are we barking up the wrong tree by looking for commercial developers to effectively subsidise the council's responsibility for affordable housing?
I think it works a bit of both ways. I think there is responsibility on the developer's side if they're going to put in a large stock of housing, definitely anything that pushes up the number of residents in an area, and quite significantly. I really do think that they should be looking to help the existing residents and improve facility, whether it's give them the housing that, you know, the council needs, whether it's improving facilities such as community facilities, whether it's offering space for community facilities such as doctor surgeries, if that is a possibility, or community centres. I do think the developer really does have a responsibility in that regard.
I would agree with you there. And I think I'm fairly sure I read when I was looking in the evening news that the developer, although they're not meeting the obligations on affordable housing, they are paying a 2.8 £8 million something levy.
The community infrastructure levy.
Yes, it's normally, this is where we've had an issue, Keep Milton Green, the Milton Forum and the Milton Neighbourhood Planning Forum. Normally we'd be quite, you know, if this development was going to go ahead, it gets planning and, you know, developers normally tend to pay into this SIL pot of money. And that's there to improve local facilities for the area. Like in Milton, it's gone towards improving classrooms in one part of Milton. It's gone to improving a playground in another. You know, it's gone to help, you know, improve facilities. But this money that they're handing over is not necessarily going into Milton's pot of money. It's to do with, so there's always ongoing stuff with the nitrates issue that's going on at the moment. But I mean, we are very lucky that in Milton that we live next to the common, and because of the bird protection there, the nature reserve that Milton Common is, they then have to pay money towards that. So that large chunk of money is not necessarily going into Milton. It will end up going into a bigger pot and helping towards the recreational sort of the amount of people using the common and things like that. Us in Milton, we're not necessarily getting any SIL money at all, which is quite upsetting, because we'll have all the, you know, the building work going on, the disruption, the increase in population. We've got a lack of school places around here and across the city. It won't necessarily go just to us. It'll be spread out, which also can be fine, but it sucks for us residents in Milton a bit that we might not see any of that money potentially.
Yeah, I get the argument that, you know, to be honest, private developers are in the business of being private developers. They're there to make a profit. I don't think that 18 million is a sniff. It's not an inconsequential. It's not but a mere, what's the thing from, I'm thinking of the Monty Python. It is but a mere.
Oh, I can't remember now.
No, anyway, don't worry. So a wafer thin mint. So, it's more than a trifle, surely. But I think there is a kind of case to be made that, yes, we shouldn't only be relying on private developers to be delivering social housing or affordable housing. And as you say, that kind of falls under much of a weirdly shaped umbrella, doesn't it? I don't know. It kind of just seems like, for me, the legislation allows the developers to cherry pick the best of sites to enable them to actually develop and sell on expensive housing, which is wonderful that people want to come and spend that sort of money in Portsmouth, but doesn't really help the locals, doesn't help the local communities, and doesn't help us actually make sure that the people that live and work here can, you know, that their families can grow in suitable surroundings and stuff.
It's frustrating that they keep. And that's not all developers. I've got to say, Homes England, although, you know, in Milton, we've had our issues with the different developers going on. You know, I can't say that about Homes England in regards to the affordable homes, because they're providing the 30%. So you're looking at sort of 35 plus homes that they will provide to local people. Mm-hmm. You know, so I can't grumble about that. And it's just a shame that the second developer sat in a very public meeting in front of a good chunk of local people and promised, you know, they knew it was something very top of our agenda along with green issues, that if this was going to get planning permission, they guaranteed they would provide this number of affordable homes. And it's a bit of a cop out, I think, in a way, to say it's not you copping out, it's a bit of a cop out from the developer to say, oh well, it's down to those lot in Milton who are a pain in the butt. We put very valid reasons as to why we think there shouldn't be that amount of housing there, settings of the hospital, the placement of it, the type of housing, the loss of green space. And they've listened and they've taken it down for whatever reason to the number it is now. But then they want to convert our lovely little chapel that we have in there. And, you know, we don't want to see that go. So they've come down for a reason. And I think they've come down for a sensible reason, but it's still not great, to be honest.
Yeah, and I think when I look at those numbers, though, Kimberly, you know, again, those detached, those what were 84 are now 58 properties.
Yeah.
You know, they are, you know, I had a brief look at the spec. I won't be buying one myself, not unless the lottery numbers come in. There's an awful lot of, you know, that reduction has, by my reckoning, has probably taken their revenue down for that development as a whole by at least 10 million. You know, because they were the 4 or 5 bed detached properties that they were looking to sell for £600,000-£700,000. So, you know, I think there is a balancing act there. And I guess the final dimension to look at is that, you know, again, some people will accuse it of being, you know, gentrification of an area. But I guess, you know, if you are going to have, you know, what effectively be 170 new families moving into that development that have the finances to purchase such properties, then, you know, if there's the ability for that to spend local, then surely that could be beneficial to some of the local businesses in Milton.
Oh, definitely. And I definitely agree with that. It's just a number of, I always say that I'm not against house building. I live in a rented house. I'd love to own my own house. Believe me, I would. But I always think that you need to build in the right places and you need to have the right infrastructure in place before you add to it.
Yeah.
And as I've said, we've got a real lack of school places, doctor surgeries. I mean, personal experience, I'm still waiting for a hospital appointment almost a year on now. And I can't see my doctor for another 8 weeks at the moment. Dental surgeries, I haven't been able to see my dentist in a year because they're almost close to closing. And the road network, we know down here in Milton that there's a problem because as a forum and working with Friends of the Earth, we fixed the little monitors up near Milton Park School, and it raised a real issue that there's real pollution down here and the queues. And also the sewage, I had a deputation at full council the other week to talk about the discharges into Langston Harbour. And I know you guys touched on it as well the other week. And to add many more people into an area that already has issues, I would rather, if possible, if there is to be building at some point, that people, whether it's government, council, focus on the local issues that we have and trying to improve them for the people who are already there before then adding further problems on top of that and making issues much, much worse. I mean, I'm not looking forward to, if this goes ahead for my kids, they're coming up to the age where I've got to apply for new schools for them over the next few years. And if this development goes ahead, that's going to personally make mine and a lot of people in the area's chances much harder. And it's just so many issues that come into it. It's not simple. It can be quite grey in some areas as well. And I do get sometimes where developers are coming from. It's just very frustrating when, you know, you've been told something over and over again, especially when it comes to the affordable housing, and then all of a sudden the hands go up and they say we can't afford to do this anymore, and they backtrack, and it's just very frustrating. And it's something I know I found it over the years. I know Cal, you know, he's done a lot of work on this as well, and it's something that's been ongoing for a very long time. And maybe the housing numbers, I think that doesn't help, that are being pushed on Portsmouth at the moment. I really don't think that helps. And I do think at some point the national government do have to step in and realise, you know, we are a city island. We can't build down because a lot of it is below sea level. We haven't got many green spaces that, I mean, we don't want to lose them anyway. And we don't want to build on them. So you either go upwards or build on green spaces. And I don't think many people want that at all. And I really think the government need to take a good long hard look and understand that we are a special case in this city, and you know, the housing numbers they place on us as a city are, I don't know where they're going to go, to be honest. And I do think that does cause a big factor in a lot of things around here as well.
I guess it's there's that in the I guess government and local councils are trying to square two probably quite incompatible things. One is that housing's so expensive because there's actually a shortage of supply, and you know it's all about supply and demand, right? If there's demand there but no supply, then the price goes up. And in some places, that's worse than others because there's a concentration of demand and a dearth of supply. But I guess the question is, how do you then end up creating more supply in places where people want it and allow it, and it's the right sort of type. Because if you just leave it to the market is by its very nature going to want to develop the things with the high profit margins. So the, you know, the four or five detached property houses that, to be fair, in best will in the world, that a lot of people are never going to be able to afford, but they at least deserve kind of a shot at being able to afford something. When you kind of, and we won't get into it because it's a whole different subject, but if you kind of look at the ratio between the you know, the value of a starter home versus the average salary now compared to, you know, the 1960s or the, you know, 1950s, there's a massive kind of a amount of difference. But where do you, I think there's a bigger strategic question of, is actually a more sensible thing, rather than trying to squeeze ever more properties into already densely populated urban areas, is actually the better thing to start new towns, you know, like you know, like the country did in the 50s and 60s with you know, with several parts of the, and is that, that's a whole other kettle of onions, as someone would say. That's a bigger kind of nut to crack that we definitely aren't going to fix in an hour.
No, I agree, and I mean, Wellbourne was just down the road, and that's been just around Fareham, and that's been ongoing for many years, and I think that's sort of ground to a halt a little bit at the moment. But you can see the level of opposition there as well, for, and you know, and that would be a whole new sort of town around there. And I don't think anyone's ever going to be happy to lose any green space. It's like I said, it's a grey area. We do need more housing. We definitely do. But like I said, I don't think it should go somewhere where, you know, there's already existing problems. I think we should need to work on the problems that we have before adding further to it.
Yeah. And just to, just before we wind up, if that was all right, Ian, unless there was something, we've got a couple of comments from the comment. Did you want to say anything, or shall I go to the comments?
No comments.
So we've got Lynn saying, Kimberly talks sense. None of what she says is unreasonable. There we go. We'll get T-shirts printed of that. And Paul says, Phil, the council should be asking tough questions about the... I think there's a, is that a mistype or just my eyes, about the non-building of social housing. So indeed, what powers do they have to actually ask those tough questions of developers in order to say, come on, you can't really plead poverty on an 18, you know, in this example. And we obviously haven't got PJ Livesey here to put across their side of the view. But from a point of view of, their, you know, developers will explore what the law allows them to do and what is in the interest of their shareholders. That's naturally what they're going to do. But, you know, what powers do councils really have to push this issue?
It is a real shame, though, because I've sat in many a planning meeting with councillors, you know, of all different colours, and the majority of the time, and the majority of them, all of us are sitting there arguing about the same thing. It's just... even there's always a worry that, you know, everyone can see that we need these affordable homes, but then we all know that there's an opportunity that if it gets, you know, thrown out, then the developer will take it straight back to the Bristol Planning Inspector. It'll go to appeal, and then the council will have to pay said costs. I find that the council often stuck. It's frustrating in a really sort of catch-22 situation where, you know, they'll fight and fight and fight, and then, you know, it'll have to go through, or they'll fight and fight and fight, it won't go through, and then, you know, the developer takes it off, and then, you know, we incur all the costs. So
lose.
I can understand how frustrating it is.
Yeah, indeed. Well, thank you for coming on and giving up part of your Sunday to talk about that one, Kimberly. It's been lovely welcoming you back on. And keep us posted with how that one goes. And is there a decision coming up with regarding to this one? Is that when it, should we watch the calendars and the?
When does it... So the main two, myself, the two forums, we've all come together, and councillors from Baffins and Milton. We've requested that it's not a piecemeal decision. Luckily the planning department have agreed, and they have agreed that they will both be heard at the planning committee in May together, side by side. So that's coming up. I don't know a date quite yet for that. And then there is one other thing coming forward, which is this week at planning committee. And that is to hear about the curtilage listing of the two villas in the grounds. We don't want them demolished. Ideally, at the moment, the developer wants them demolished and turned into some very hideous blocks of flats. we don't want that. We want to preserve them because they're done by a lovely architect in the area. They're very old. They're over 100 years old. So, yeah, it's definitely worth listening to that. Hopefully that will get thrown out and we'll get to get some curtilage listing on them anyway.
Excellent. Well, we'll keep our ears peeled. Kimberly. Thank you very much, Kimberly.
Thanks as always. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so what's next on our greedy's
shall
good?
Shall we go order? Council Joe, do you want to go council chamber back, or do you fancy a bit of a dally around the vaccines world?
Do you know what? I can't decide. I used to be indecisive, but now I'm not sure. Let's go with the council chamber thing anyway. Let's go with there. So we've got some recorded comments from Councillor Terry Norton and from Councillor Gerald Vernon Jackson. So shall we kind of dive straight in? Because I think Gerald explains kind of a bit of context for us with the with his pre-recorded interview. So let's try and make sure that works. Those of you following live, please welcome and thank you for having the patience to bear with us twice in the space of 4 days. But please do let us know if there's a technical problem with this, and I'll try to turn my mic off when I start swearing, because that might happen. So here we go.
So Gerald, thanks for giving us your views on the government failure to actually extend the measures. What can you give us a background as to what is actually isn't happening rather than what should?
Okay, so for the last year, councils have run their meetings remotely on Zoom or on Teams so that people don't have to get together in rooms. It's worked remarkably well, and that seems to have been a useful thing to have done over the last year to stop people having to get together in rooms to meet. And therefore pass on the infection.
And how is it that this has come to a head? That they're
So the powers to do this finish on May the 6th, and the government have chosen not to renew them. So we're going to be going back to meetings physically. So on May the 17th, there will be around 70 people in a room doing our annual meeting, and sometimes our meetings go on for up to 10 hours, and it just seems bizarre that when Public Health England are saying that infection rates are going to go back up again, the government are pushing people to meet in rooms with up to 70 people at a time for long periods of time, particularly when some councillors may be at high risk of catching the virus, or if they do catch the virus, at high risk of suffering very badly from it.
And are councils like Portsmouth, are they able to put in any other practical kind of steps to mitigate those sorts of risks at all?
Well, I think what we'll have to do is try to meet in as bigger rooms as possible so that people are able to be socially distanced. But we'll see. I think there's big pressure on from councils of all political persuasions for the government to change their mind. It would take a minister 10 minutes to sort this out, but at the moment they don't seem to be interested in doing so.
So that was Leader of the Council Gerald Vernon Jackson's view on the subject. Shall we talk a little bit about that, or should we get straight into Terry's?
Let's see what Terry's thoughts are.
So we've Terry's given us a bless him, he's given us a lot of his time, so he's given us a good lengthy contribution, so we've split it into two just to give us a chance to talk around it. But here is the first part of Terry's contribution, and here we go.
I am in favour of returning to face-to-face meetings if we can do it safely, and I'm confident that we can. It's been a difficult year, hasn't it, with many council officers, the majority of them working from home. And that's led to some issues, I think, in terms of immediacy and in terms of communication. So where elected officials can meet face to face safely, which I'm confident we can, I think we should be doing that, really. It will restore, I think, confidence in us as a council and as elected officials to make important decisions and uphold democracy. And it's been stifled slightly with some of the technical issues that we've had with online meetings and people's internet dropping out and not being able to connect and all those sort of issues. And surprisingly, it's the Liberal Democrat administration at the moment who appear to be in favour of remaining online and not having face-to-face meetings. But it's them who have the most technical issues with, you know, internet dropping out and not being able to grasp some of the technology, sharing screens and things like that. And I just think it doesn't really look good on a council when we've got those kind of issues. It makes us look sloppy. So I am in favour of returning to online meetings. We saw many of these issues at the last full council meeting, and surprisingly, Simon left these bits out of your podcast last week. But there are a plethora of issues from the Lib Dem administration, from cabinet members not knowing who was answering what question, and then asking to come back to it, and that sort of messing up the order slightly. And I think that's a very difficult position when we start, messing with standing orders. Screens were being shared, and of course the deputy leader of the council, Councillor Steve Pitt, said about the leader of the council, he doesn't know what he's doing, and that was caught from his microphone being left on. And it's just an embarrassing situation for us as a council as a whole, really. Non-politicos don't really get involved, I don't think, with party politics. They just want us to appear competent, and they want to have faith that we know what we're doing. And I think it reflects quite poorly on us as a council when we've got those kind of issues as a whole. Forget party politics, just us as a group of elected members that are brought forward to make important decisions. So
I've trimmed him a little bit there, so forgive us, Councillor Norton, but I think we kind of got the gist of your point. What were your views, Ian, on what Councillor Norton said there?
It's a balancing act, isn't it? I mean, I think, there is an element of we've all existed in that Zoom environment or that Teams environment. You're on mute. I had an AGM last night with my cricket chums, and somebody pointed out that my camera was entirely facing my chest rather than my head. You get these dropouts. So I think it is, whilst it's been essential, it isn't optimal. So I think, I think Terry's right there. It perhaps doesn't look good. Is it a case of the public would forgive that? I think most people who've operated on online meetings will understand that those things go wrong. I would step to your defence, if I may, in that we Simon has the job of taking a 10-hour council meeting and editing it into probably two or three-minute sections. Maybe this for our next album, Simon, we can have a bloopers reel, and you can cut those bits out and stitch them together into a package. So, no, we didn't pick up on the technical issues last week or last meeting, but I think it's always going to be a balancing act.
It is, and to be honest, as much as someone might say they're trying not to be party political, the Liberal Democrats aren't the only party that had suffered from technical issues, and they certainly aren't the only party that had suffered from situations where someone had left their mic open and they shouldn't have done, and they certainly aren't the only party that had councillors not sure what they were actually voting on and needed to actually check that with the council with the officers or with the Lord Mayor. So if I'm honest, I do find, aside from the broader question of, as an example of democracy in action, would people rather see it live in the council chamber, or would they rather have a rather stream? Because to be honest, to most people that are watching, to be fair, I'd gamble that a large proportion of the people watching are actually the people heavily involved in campaigning in Portsmouth politics anyway, and the members of the public that aren't interested in political campaigning that are watching, I should imagine actually it's easier for them to follow it from home. Whether the video is coming from the council chamber or whether the video is coming from, you know, I've sat through the council, the meetings in the council chamber, and usually there's no more than six people actually watching, and those, and as the meeting goes on, those numbers kind of die down. So I don't think the public are that bothered by the difference, and companies up and down the country are having to get used to working professionally with internet meetings, and I don't think it's a problem for a country in the 21st century to operate a 21st century democracy.
Now, the thing that I missed was that it's the 17th of May. Now, that is the next date for there's the April the 12th date for the next level of unlocking, and then May the 17th is the next date before we get to June the 21st normality day. So I kind of, and look, there's
things
an element
may change,
of
yeah.
At some point we're going to be back to normal. And June the 21st looks like normality day. But I don't think any of us are really certain as to what that normality is or will be. And if it's, you know, masks off, social distance done, let's all get on with life as we did before, then for me, I can't see why you wouldn't extend the period where you meet virtually out to June the 21st.
It does seem to be a particular...
Let's make one change.
Yeah.
But I guess... Sorry, just to finish. Yeah, I guess if realistically the June and beyond is still going to be masks, is still going to be social distance, is still going to be those baseline hands, face, space precautions, then May the 17th is almost as good a date as any.
Well, it is, but the AGM normally takes place kind of the week, you know, immediately, you know, not necessarily the day. It doesn't take place the day after the election. And also, it's going to take longer to count the election, because the council have already said that they're not going to be performing the count overnight like they normally would, because people will be too tired to socially distance properly. And to be fair, some people in some parties take the opportunity to frequent the bar rather than observe the count. And neither of those things will be conducive to maintaining a safe environment. I think that, as I understand it, and although this plan is yet to be written, I think the idea is to put particular wards into different rooms around the Guildhall so that you're kind of segregating off. But let's not deprive ourselves of the rest of Terry's contribution, because he was good enough to send us lots of contributions. So let's hear the rest of what he's got to say.
These issues would be avoided if we were meeting in person. We can do it safely because, you know, the council chamber is a big space. You know, this idea that we're all crammed in there like sardines just isn't true. There's plenty of space for us to be able to social distance and give us a chance, you know, at appearing far more competent. So, yes, I'm in favour of returning to face-to-face meetings, where we have committees and planning and licensing. Again, I think they could be done in the council chamber or in a space where we could socially distance. And it would give us a better crack at, you know, upholding democracy and adhering to standards, really. If I were a resident or a developer, let's say, for planning that brought an application forward and the online meeting was stop and start and kept dropping out and people were there and weren't there and there were questions over whether they can vote because they'd heard the whole of the meeting and all of those sort of things, I think I'd feel a little bit disappointed if an outcome didn't go my way.
I don't really kind of have anything else to say other than what I've said already about I don't really think the people at large are bothered about it.
Yeah, and often with these issues, it is, you know, I guess, you know, you look at it two ways, isn't it? It's that, how, I think many people are craving normal. And yeah. You know, as I say, whether you do it on May the 17th or June the 21st, kind of ambivalent. But let's hopefully all of the measures will follow through and we can get back to some sort of normalcy. Is that a word, or have I just made that?
Normality, I think, is probably normality. Probably
yeah.
a better
yeah,
one.
So that's probably better. Yeah. So I think that's something that we can all crave.
Indeed, but it was interesting that there were some different particular points about actually the physicality of the council chamber itself. And Councillor Norton rightly points out there's lots of space in the council chamber. So you know, is that, you know, it might be an issue in other councils who are, you know, who don't have such large chambers in which to meet, or large spaces at their disposal. But is there a way to make it work in that space? I don't think it's beyond the wit of the fine people at the council to make that work.
Perfect. Right. So vive la vaccines.
Yeah. So we've got a particular clip that that talks about, there's a particular comment that was made about vaccines and about how that works. So shall I
start by just framing the vaccines discussion and the EU UK position and kind of where we find ourselves now. So and again, I'm going back to last Tuesday. So there is an element of, if you look at the vaccine programs in the UK and the EU, they were both at very different states of play. So as of last Tuesday, 40% of the UK population had received their first shot of the vaccine, compared to 13% in the EU. So we had effectively, we were three times as far along the piece, and that then started to lead to a bit of saber rattling on both sides about potential vaccine exports. Now, I have worked in this area, so I do have a little bit of insight. And effectively, the difference that the manufacturers are working with, I've got a little bit of insight into the Pfizer world, and The Economist covered the AstraZeneca, so it seems very similar, is that the two contracts that were, basically the contracts are very similar in terms of the UK contract is very much time bound, with targets along the route that have to be hit. And there are significant commercial penalty clauses in there if that schedule is not met. The EU contract is more open in its nature, in that it quotes an end figure and an end date. But in terms of the delivery schedule, along that route, that's much more open and talks only of best endeavours from both Pfizer and AstraZeneca. Now, the complication, of course, is that Pfizer's manufacturing facility is all in the EU. So anything that comes to the UK will be an export. AstraZeneca have a number of manufacturing sites, some in the UK, some in the EU. So the UK will receive a mix of doses that have been made in the UK and doses that will have been made in the EU. So if we look at it as a whole, you know, there is this piece where AstraZeneca have got more plants and more subcontractors coming on line. So they're very confident they will hit the end date for the EU and the end volumes. But where it's tight at the moment, the two contracts means that both Pfizer and AZ do have to favour the UK over the EU. And I guess if you were an EU citizen, you're going to be pretty cross about that.
Yeah, this is probably the point where some people might be expecting me to rally to the defence of the EU. Because I don't know if you can see in the corner of the shot, I playfully put my EU flag flag out. But
are you going to break into Ode to Joy?
No, I'm not any more than later on. We're going to play Land of Hope and Glory. Exactly. So, we couldn't afford the rights. Nope. So, actually, no. Look, to be really honest, the EU have bungled this. They didn't do the contracting as well. They haven't done the organisation of it as well. And unfortunately, their contractual arrangements have taken a lower priority from a fulfillment perspective than other countries' arrangements have done. I'll repeat it again because we did say it on Sunday. Well, I did say it on Sunday. What the UK have done in regards to the contracting in this issue, I think we've got that absolutely right. We've made sure that the contracts are tight, that there is some wiggle room, but with agreement and with penalty clauses if not, and that also that we've actually secured supply from a variety of different pharmaceutical companies, which also makes sense. You don't put all your eggs in one basket. So to be fair, in that respect, of the many things I've criticised this government about them organising the contracting of the purchasing of the vaccines, I would not and cannot and am not. I'm sorry the EU have buggered this up. And for them to then, to be honest, fall for the Prime Minister's blathering phone nationalism of, you know, blah, 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 there are vaccines, blah, 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 all of this kind of malarkey, and to then come out with their own kind of so-called vaccine nationalism of themselves just isn't a good look for them, doesn't work. It doesn't work from an EU perspective. Both the EU and the UK need to remember that neither of those the EU isn't a country, but the EU nor the UK have actually manufactured the vaccines themselves. They've been manufactured by pharmaceutical companies that have had some degree of support, both financial or material, from governmental bodies, but nonetheless they don't own anything other than the vaccines that they've purchased. And if it's a contractual disagreement, see my earlier comment about the contract being piss poor.
So what's Terry got to say on the subject?
So let's hear what Terry's got to say. So again, forgive us, Terry. We've kind of broken you into two bits, but I don't think I needed. I don't think I trimmed any of this off this one. So here's Terry on vaccines, part one.
I think it's absolutely fine to say that we are doing a good job for the people of this country, and it's difficult nowadays, isn't it, in the woke society that we live in, where everything is taken out of context and spun to cause, you know, outrage and offence. But, you know, we've developed a vaccination in this country. We've given it to the people of this country first, and it's okay to do that. And for that, I think the country, the nation, are thankful. Now, that's difficult to hear, I think, for those who like to talk Britain down, and there are plenty of them on the council. I imagine all this good news is probably quite hard to take, but, you know, without sounding like a flag waver, you know, isn't it amazing what you can achieve when you're no longer fighting for scraps around the EU table? So despite all the fear-mongering and the negativity that was constantly pushed by the Remainers, many of the Liberal Democrats on the council, Great Britain has done a good job. And we are the envy of other nations in Europe. And you know, don't take it from me. You can take it from the German tabloids, who were writing things like, Britain, we envy you. And in some of the headlines that we saw over here, things like, we have a forward-thinking procurement plan. We're the leading large nation. And there were some quotes I remember which said something along the lines of, you know, for frothing Ramonas, nothing can be more depressing. You know, if you're a self-loathing liberal Brit, the fact that we're doing a great job with this vaccination rollout. And that wasn't coming from, you know, Daily Mail or Guido Fawkes or anything like that. That was the, you know, Labour-loving, Tory-hating Guardian that were writing those sort of things. So when you've got anti-government press patting us on the back, we must be doing a decent job. Now,
we'll pause him there just for the, just to give us a chance to try and dissect that particular element. You go first, Ian.
Oh, I think Terry's obviously he's very enthusiastic at that point. He's gone on a bit of a roll. He's had a poke at some of the, you know, some of the remaining elements. So you know, I kind of it's a very bold statement he's made there. I think there are some points in there in terms of, you know, that there is an element of, and again, look, you're always going to get this tension, and particularly when you talk about flag waving and you know, being very pro-Britain and land of hope and glory. And I think, you know, for me, it's an interesting one. It's a little bit like the Brexit and the Remain, isn't it? You know, you're going to have some people singing loud of hope and glory and waving the flag, and you're going to have some extremists who, you know, will describe the flag as a, you know, a tissue of, you know, post-colonial Britain and blah, 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 blah. You know, so they're going to be extremists on both sides. I think Terry's getting a tad enthusiastic there, but I think if we pull out the core message that hooray for a great vaccines rollout, I don't think there are, I'm going to disagree with Terry, I don't think there are any people who are going to be disappointed that we've got a decent vaccines rollout and hope that it would have been worse so that they could point at Brexit and say, yeah, yeah, it's all its fault.
Yeah, you use the word bold. I would perhaps use different words. It seems that the only people getting excited about linking Brexit with the vaccine are people that were in favour of it. Look, guys, you won. We've left. Get on with it. It's a done deal. Why do you keep going on about it? I don't understand what the point of that is. It is worth pointing out that being a member of the EU wouldn't have stopped us making our individual arrangements that we currently have with pharmaceutical companies, because many European countries chose not to take part in the EU-wide scheme that, as I said earlier on, has been utterly bungled. So I think it's a bit of a shame. Let's not, you know, let's not kind of let the whistles of land and hope and glory kind of blind ourselves to all of the things that are going well with the vaccine rollout and with, as I've said, with the contracting of actually the arrangement of purchasing those vaccines. Let's solemnly remember that 127,000 people have died in this country, and that our country has actually one of the highest fatality rates for COVID, you know, for per capita. So I don't think it's appropriate to get all celebratory and misty-eyed about a bit of flag waving about this particular bit that is going very, very well. And as I said, it is going very, very well. So I think it's a shame to drag Brexit into that, because it's not relevant. And I think it's a shame to disrespect actually the country by suggesting that nationalism and patriotism are the same thing. I love my country just as much as the next person, but that doesn't mean that I can't criticise it when it does things that are silly.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, we're in an interesting space, aren't we?
We are indeed.
In that regard, in terms of when does patriotism become nationalism and when does nationalism become extremism? And, you know, there are, you know, and it's interesting because, again, you and I frequent political forums, and, you know, for me, I think your position, and you've been very clear all along about your, you know, the Remain in the EU. And I think there is a position where you've been, you know, very, very forthright in saying it is over, it is done. Those that wanted it and have it now need to get on with it. But there is still a significant vocal minority that are almost still trying to win the argument that it was the wrong thing to do.
I still don't think it was the right thing to do, but it's done.
No.
No one with a sound mind and the ability to electorally deliver it is talking about rejoining the European Union. At the end of the day, we are where we are. We've got to make the best out of the situation and the opportunities that we are in, because we are in this situation, and that is not going to change. I just wish that the people that championed getting us to this situation would actually also own some of the problems, and some of those will be solved with time, because that's the nature of evolutionary change in the marketplace. Yeah. Let's just, again, I didn't want it to be a conversation about Brexit, but it was because Terry brought it in to the conversation.
Yeah,
so,
and I think it's right that we should acknowledge it and have those conversations. I think if we move on to the vaccines rollout, I think the positive, and you touched on it just before we went into that, is the fact that, you know, Moderna, which is the third vaccine in the UK, is scheduled to arrive towards the end of April. You know, April, there's talk of there being a bit of a slowdown in first vaccinations, which there will be, so that we conserve the stocks of Pfizer and AZ for those that are due for their second round. Moderna will come on. Now, I think there's two more, Petrovax and the other one, you know, which you know, means that I think by the time we get to sort of May, June, not only will we be continuing the vaccine, you know, we'll be able to stamp back on the accelerator again. And hopefully, you know, by that stage, there will be so much production capacity that you know, the EU can also step on the accelerator and catch back up again.
Indeed. Lynn makes a comment in our comments that she voted Remain, but love Land of Hope and Glory. But would still like to share nicely. So there is an argument about as we race now to vaccinate people that are further and further away from the high, so you know, the high risk, the statistically yep. high risk groups, while actually there being people in countries that we want to go on holiday to or to trade with or, you know, to have a connection with, that they're actually still not able to fulfill getting the most vulnerable actually vaccinated. Is that really fulfilling, you know, does that really help us? I think there was a comment made on Twitter by a member of the European Parliament today about, you know, what use is it to vaccinate your entire island if that's the only place you can go. Their words, not mine.
I've missed a memo, I think, is something possibly that's happened to me at some point in my life, because I don't know when the world changed that meant that you had to go on holiday abroad every year, or you weren't living an active and fulfilling life, that your life was ruined if you couldn't go for your 2 weeks in Torremolinos. I don't know when that memo came out. I missed it. The last time I travelled on my own passport was 1995, which was my honeymoon. Now, I've been all around the world with work, but that's because I've got business class buttocks, not economy class buttocks. But there does seem to be an awful lot of, will we get our summer holiday this year?
Yeah, but a similar thing played out over Christmas, and look how that happened. About 50% of the fatalities in the UK occurred in January, February. And that's because of the issues around, you know, the press doing stuff about Johnson fighting the scientists to save Christmas, and then having to actually turn around and say, you know, a couple of days before Christmas, sorry, it's not going to happen. Let's not kid ourselves into the same situation again. It's not the same same environment virologically, because obviously there's going to be lots of people vaccinated by that point. But as much as I can understand people's yearning to celebrate and make use of the freedoms that have been necessarily deprived of them over the last year, let's take a breath. Let's be cautious. I mean, only yesterday we took that further tentative step towards a bit more normality. You know, the rule of six came back in. But enough of us. Let's play the Terry's last bit so that we can make sure that we've got all of those in. So let's have our last segment from Councillor Terry Norton.
You know, in terms of the European Union, now my understanding is that they had every opportunity to develop and set up vaccination centres, but like usual, they left it months too late to get things going. It was surrounded in red tape and all of that sort of nonsense, and now they are behind. So, you know, of course we should support you know, other nations and Europe if need be, but there's nothing wrong with saying that we're going to look after you know, our nation first. I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all. So it's a shame, because this will probably dent the future relationship that we're going to have with the EU, but that all seems to be coming from one side, and I don't think it's the UK that are making demands and have that sense of entitlement and pointing fingers. It seems to be coming from the European Union. So I hope that they can sorted out sooner rather than later. And of course, you know, we should support them as a nation, but that doesn't mean, you know, at the cost of the British public.
I do hope he washes his flag after he's done what he's just done with it.
No, yeah, I personally, as I say, he got a bit bold on the first one, but that one for me makes perfect sense. And if I was an EU citizen, and I'd be, you know, to your point about holding your government to account, you would be pointing across the water and saying, well, how come you couldn't manage it? And I think that, we're at that stage where, look, I think in terms of a future relationship, we. It's in everybody's interest to make it work, isn't it?
It is.
There is a flow of goods backwards and forwards between the two nations. And I think in this regard, I don't think the UK has done anything wrong by negotiating strong contracts. And we're at a point now where it's in everybody's interest to get as many arms full of vaccine-y goodness as we possibly can, as quickly as we can.
Indeed, but how many vaccines have left this country to go to other places? Zero. How many vaccines have come from other countries to this country? Millions.
If we haven't got the, I think I addressed that in the first piece. Pfizer don't manufacture vaccines here. You know, so there is an element of we never go. You know, if you, that was first, AZ was second, and the majority of AZ's manufacturing capability is on mainland Europe. So it's a bit of a non-stat. You know, we haven't given away a single dose of Pfizer vaccine. Well, no, we haven't, because we don't make it. You know, perhaps if you look back in the day, 3 years ago, we would have been in a position where, in terms of Pfizer vaccine, multiple millions of doses would have left the plant at Havant to go all over the world.
Indeed, but as we said earlier on, that the companies making or the manufacturer of the vaccines are pharmaceutical companies. They're not the EU, and they're not the UK. So all of this grandstanding and this kind of the vaccine nationalism is an unfortunate sideshow. But in order to reach reasonable agreement, you need to have a reasonable conversation with reasonable people, and part of that requires them to, you know, some, you know, both parties to wind down the rhetoric and to sit down and actually talk honestly. But unfortunately, I wouldn't trust Boris Johnson to do that in a snow shower. So
look, I get the fact you know, and look, I'm not a great supporter of Boris as a leader. I've been openly critical of him on this podcast and in other places. But I think, you know, if we look at this, the thing that we can both agree on is that the rhetoric needs to wind down.
Indeed.
The saber rattling needs to stop.
Yes.
And ultimately, it's in everybody's interest to get as many arms full of vaccine as they possibly can do in as short a time as possible.
And that sounds like a good place to end it on.
Yep.
Characteristic
God bless Bill
agreement.
Gates and the lizard people. You've been listening to the Pompey Politics Podcast.
Blue and yellow till we die.
I'm Ian Lizard Morris.
And I'm Simon Sainsbury. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Pompey Politics Podcast. If you want to make sure you get notifications about upcoming shows and get to know when we're live, we normally broadcast live 6:27 p.m. on a Sunday evening, then follow us on Facebook at Pompey Politics Podcast. You can also follow us on Twitter at Pompey Politics One. Please, if you'd like to, feel free to leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts, and you can even ask Alexa to play the podcast for you. Alexa, play the latest episode of the Pompey Politics Podcast.
Getting Pompey Politics Podcast, Blue and Yellow Till We Die from Amazon Music.
Alexa,
playing the latest episode.
Stop. See? It's easy.